This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, break 'em to make 'em, the heroes who rise from the ashes.
You know, that something must be said. There is just something so delightful about destroying a character.
Yes, another option for this episode title would have been First Choose Your Victim.
You know, I often say that you can always tell who my favourite character is because I make them hurt the most.
You're like God with Job.
I resent that.
Is it in any way inaccurate?
I still resent it.
Okay, so what we're really looking at in this episode is how you can really get to new depths of your character by pretty much stripping away everything they've got. And I'll tell you what, I'll sum this up much better with a quote from, bizarrely, Firefly. This is from the episode 10, which is called War Stories, and it's a supposed quote to an 8th century Chinese general called Shen Yu, who didn't actually really exist. There's lots of Shen Yus, but there's nothing to attribute this particular saying to him. I think they might have sort of modelled it off of Sun Tzu and the article. Yeah. Anyway, this is what they say. Live with a man 40 years, share his house, his meals, speak on all subjects. You will not know him. Tie him up, hold him over the volcano's edge, and on that day you will finally meet the man.
See, it raises the question of what makes a person.
Yeah.
And in the case of this episode, what then makes a hero? And I remember studying philosophy and this question being posed to me, and someone said, what's braver? Acting spontaneously without thought or hesitating and then acting? And they gave me an example, which is, let's say you're there and you have there's a child who's fallen off the edge of a boat, right? And into the water. And you know that if you jump in, it's almost certain death. But is it then braver to just go, oh my gosh, my child, I should say, yeah, it's your child. My child has fallen over the edge of a boat and jump straight in without any thought. Or is it braver to go, oh my God, I could die, hesitate, and then jump? What's true bravery?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? And I think in that situation, obviously, you've got the level of instinct involved as well.
Yeah. And it is a question, which is bravery, and you know, you see it come up a lot in things, is bravery inherent action, just sort of instinctual action? Are we instinctually brave, or is bravery the decision to sacrifice yourself in favour of something else, having thought about it? Is bravery dismissal of fear?
Is there a difference between bravery and courage?
There's a question. We're getting to the deep ones now.
No, I was reading something in the library archives recently, and it was basically First World... No, it wasn't First World. What am I talking about? It was written in 1735, and they were basically saying that if you're well-bred, you may have courage because you have reason and you have the right developed mind to actually develop something such as courage. But, you know, the average ordinary man could show bravery, and that bravery was basically the defeat of fear, the acceptance of it within yourself and the defeat of it. Courage was accepting fear on behalf of others, like a general.
See, I feel like I know who wrote this.
Yeah. It was interesting to read that perspective. And once I got over the fact that the Fs and the Ss were pretty much interchangeable in that script, I worked out what was being said. But yeah, I wouldn't say I necessarily agreed with it. And it was clearly a piece of propaganda that was very much leaning towards the gentry and the nobility.
Yeah.
Being a better class of person because of birth.
Of course, yeah.
Philosophizing and deep questions aside, what would your definition of courage and bravery, either or, be?
I think definitely it would be the latter of the two that I suggested, which is that true bravery is actually accepting the risks, accepting fear, and sort of dismissing them. That's not to say that, you know, someone who acts out of on instinct is not commendable, but I think true bravery is when you just do something despite knowing the risks.
Yeah, I have to say there is something for really meeting yourself. A time you will really meet yourself is when you are genuinely afraid of something and you stop and you make the choice to go ahead and do something anyway because you personally believe it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, and again, that's not to say that people who act on instinct are not brave, but I wonder whether you can then actually make the difference between bravery and courage. I think to act, that's courageous. If you act in a way, is sort of dangerous for the sake of others, that could be described as courageous, regardless of whether you've thought of it or not. But yeah, I think bravery, true bravery, comes from having made considerations.
I would use them almost interchangeably, because I wouldn't say either of them exist in the absence of fear. I think they exist in spite of it. That's my personal viewpoint.
So yeah, today's episode is also a little bit about, Jill suggested it, because basically in the next week, Blood of the Delphi is coming out, so you know, I wanted to do a little bit of a promotion, and so we were thinking about what we could possibly do the episode on. And Jill suggested we do it on this because I have a reputation for utterly destroying characters.
Yes. And, you know, basically going back to that Firefly quote, that's basically what Madeline's done with most of her characters. She's metaphorically tied them up and left them at the edge of a volcano. So we really get to meet her characters in book two.
I do tend to agree that there's rawness. You will meet a person when they are at their worst, and actually, well, that's a little bit unfair, because it depends on what we mean by meet, and you know, it depends what how we perceive human nature. And so actually, if a person lives their life very merrily, having never, you know, been to the edge of a volcano, then it's fair to say that what they're showing other people isn't necessarily a lie, because actually I don't think a person really knows themselves until they're in that situation.
No, it's just as I was saying, until you've had that moment where you're genuinely frightened. And yeah. I don't just mean sort of like, oh, that's a bit scary. I mean genuinely, your instinct is to run away.
Yeah.
That's a sober mirror to look into, let's say. And obviously there is the element of, if you're a writer, then you have to talk to your characters, because they're not your children.
Not your children. They deserve it. In most cases, they actually don't. But yeah, I feel, especially when you're writing heroes, it's important to have to torture them, because that will be... And it's a little bit unfair in some ways, but the defining feature for a hero in most stories is the ability to actually choose the right path when there's nothing.
Yeah, or even to come back in off the wrong path.
Yeah.
Because that's something that we've talked about heroes and villains, so to speak, before, and or, you know, antagonists at least. And quite often what separates them is the fact that an antagonist will not step off a wrong path. Yeah. Will either consciously continue following it or say, well, this is what fate thrust me onto. It was fate's fault, and therefore I am made to be like this.
I'm trying to think of examples of characters who, and it goes beyond just, I know that if I go down this path, I'll die.
Yes, it does. I mean, there are far worse things than dying for a start.
Yeah, but it's also characters who haven't just sacrifice their living life, but have sacrificed their life in a way that perhaps, here's one. I have a sort of a touch and go kind of relationship with Snape from Harry Potter.
Yep.
I don't like him. I think he's a bully. But you can't argue that there's a heroic element about him as well, regardless of the fact that it's motivated by selfishness and regret. This is a person who actually, in the end, sacrificed his good name, lost everything, was an enemy to the people with whom he was actually an ally. And that, I mean, that kind of sacrifice, I think that's why a lot of people like Snape, because it really hurts them. It hurts them to go that, hang on, even I, the reader, didn't like this character, and now I realise I was wrong. He was on our side. This entire time he's been on our side.
He was very classically playing the role of a spy, whereby right up until they make their last act, you can't be 100% sure whose side they're on.
Yeah.
And then somehow it hits you a lot more hard when you find out actually they were on your side and they've just undergone something horrible.
Of which they can never be. Yeah. And he dies, and there's no redemption for him in that sense. He gets redeemed in that people know his sacrifice, but he suffered in his life, and then he died. And that was that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's definitely an argument that there were two heroes at the end of the Deathly Hallows, and one was Harry, and then there was the dark hero, which was Snape, and Snape's actions actually allowed Harry to continue his own.
Yeah.
Which, obviously, Snape's preserved memories told Harry what he needed to do. But then the Deathly Hallows is an interesting book, and quite a lot of people don't really like it that much. You know, I think it's one of my favourite of the series, but it's that sort of twisty plot where nothing's really quite straightforward that I would appreciate. But there's things like, you start off thinking, oh my god, Hedwig's dead, which I know is a very, very minor thing, but Hedwig's been his contact with the outside world for such a long time.
Yeah, she literally has been. She's, when he's at the Dursleys, that is his link to the wizarding world.
So it really is representative of him having everything severed, everything taken away, and throughout the book, gradually more and more gets stripped away from him. And it's again that same feeling of, you know, you meet the character, because when everything, all the accoutrements, all the friends, everything else, what's left at the end of it? And if you haven't got much left, I mean, let's look at it another way. If you were to do this to, say, Peter Pettigrew,
yeah,
there would not be very much there.
No, and you know, you do look at it another way, which is that there's this element of not only of people are quite scared of the no return thing.
Yeah.
And Hedwig's death was a definite sense of no return. There was no return from this. This was not a life that he was ever going to be able to go back to. And in some respects, you're like, well, he never really wanted to go back to it. But in other respects, suddenly there's a lot of uncertainty, because, yeah, we like to know we can go back even if we don't want to. We like to have the choice, and that the choice was removed. And to make decisive sacrifices like that, it's one of the hardest things we can do is to make decisions which we can't return from, which we have to then stick to.
Yeah, even if they're not life and death, even if they're a case of, well, life is never going to be the same after this.
Yeah.
Or, you know what, I'm choosing obscurity so that somebody else can have their moment in the sun, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or I'm choosing to step back because I can see those two people would be better together, even though I would like to be involved.
Yeah, exactly.
So lots of different types. I'm just going to quickly look at one or two other examples, and then we'll go back to Blood of the Delphi. Okay. Obviously, I've got a lot.
This is revenge time.
No, I haven't even started revenge yet. This is the prelude to revenge. I just want to quickly mention Buffy, obviously, of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and yep, particularly the last season. There is a scene at the end of season two, I'm a complete Buffy nerd, so I'd know this, whereby she's fighting Angel, and Angel's saying, okay, take away everything, take away your friends, your weapons, and what's left, and she says, me, and she beats him. Yep. And that's actually, it wasn't at the time intended that way, but it works out as good foreshadowing for the last season, whereby she slowly has everything taken away from her, right to the point where her friends and allies turn on her, which is one of the most horrible and yet one of the most effective parts of the entire series, I think. And obviously she does win in the end, but at great cost. And the great cost is that it's a really big gamble. It's great in some ways because now she's able to share the power that she's got. She's not alone anymore. But it also means that she's responsible for all these potential, basically overstrong psychopaths who could be out there doing whatever they want. I mean, if you remember how dangerous Faith was, the rogue vampire slayer, when she went off the rails. And now she's got hundreds of them all over the world.
Awkward.
So, yeah. But I think it does illustrate that she has that horrible defeat. Everybody turns on her. She's on her own, essentially. And, yeah, having had all that taken away from her, yeah, she has a bit of a mope. We all would, wouldn't we?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's fair, to be honest.
And what it turns out is the fact that she feels responsible for all the people who are dying. And it's not really her fault they're dying. They're going to die. It's that she's having to make the decisions that's killing them.
Yeah.
Once again, you really meet the character. You've known the character for a long time, but it's only when they absolutely hit rock bottom like that I think you can see the real tensile strength, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you on that.
And it's certainly something that comes up a lot in epic fantasy. You'll have a character who It's like the darkest part of the hero's journey. And it's usually only a fraction of a book, usually. Or it's one small book in a long series. And it is the part where everything's really dark. Everything looks like it's going to go wrong. It doesn't look like anything can come right out of this. You know, it's really, really bad. It's that bad. And the hero doesn't even know who they are themselves anymore, almost.
Yeah.
And it's certainly, as I said, something that comes up in a lot of epic fantasy. Obviously, if you've got many, many different characters in epic fantasy, they can all go through this part of the journey at different points. So you'll get a dark thread with one character arc, and it won't necessarily be the entire arc that's overreaching. That's the problem.
Yeah. And yeah, it also tends to be that it's a moment of reflection where not only do we get to know the character and they get to know themselves, they usually have to overcome something within themselves during that time. And it's the reason, and what allows them to overcome it is the fact that they've been put in a situation where they truly know themselves, and they become aware of themselves in a way that they've never been aware of themselves before.
Yeah, I mean, okay, well, moving on to Blood of the Delphi, you would think at the end of the Sons of Thestian, and okay, if you haven't read it, go away and read it and don't listen to the rest of this till afterwards, okay? Because I'm not going to talk around spoilers for this particular bit.
Yeah,
for Sons
okay,
of Thestian.
So, yeah, if anyone hasn't read, we might as well go straight into it. Well, the next bit is going to be spoiler galore, so...
Scootle off, read the book, and then come back. Okay, great. Yeah, so at the end of Sons of Thestian, you've got Rufus, who has discovered that Yonatan was his brother, but he's dead.
Awkward.
And he's essentially becoming an exile. He's also discovered his real birth mother's dead as well. Okay. He's essentially becoming an exile, and he's become a parent almost at a very, very young age as he takes care of his brother.
Yeah.
Which is Joshua. And you'd think, really, that Rufus has really hit rock bottom there.
Oh, no.
But no, that's not rock bottom. That's like way, way, way above rock bottom.
You see, the thing is, Rufus could have hit rock bottom, but the thing that prevented him hitting rock bottom was that he was given a purpose and he was made to feel useful. And that, it was, he had room left. He had room left because had Joshua been dead, Joshua been dead at the beginning, after, you know, Elian thought he was dead, had that actually been true, Rufus probably would have spiraled out of control, and would have probably gone on a murderous rampage, let's not lie. But because he had something to concentrate his energies on, he didn't hit rock bottom because he had something to grip onto, a ledge, as it were. And that wasn't actually necessarily healthy in some ways. Ultimately, he was able to sort of pull himself up a little bit higher. But in doing so, what he did was he focused all of his grief and loss and kind of replaced the pain of one thing with the joy of another in a typically unhealthy Rufus way of dealing with things. He just didn't want to deal with what was happening with Yonatan, so he replaced him in some ways. Not really, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, and obviously we've seen his tendency towards that sort of repression with Milane,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, to mirror this, you've got Zachary, who essentially is victorious at the end of the Sons of Thestian because he's got Sverin back, and yet it's a very Pyrrhic victory. It's empty.
Yeah.
And you can kind of tell that at the time. You can tell that Zachary's definitely having some second thoughts already, and Sverin's only been back 5 seconds.
Yeah, Zachary's nervous because, and I've said this before, he, unlike Rufus, actually has a very black and white view of the world.
Yeah.
Things are either good or they're bad, very simply put. And he tends to put people onto pedestals. So if he likes you, then you're the best. That's that. If he doesn't like you, then you're pretty much the worst. He sees things in a very black and white way. And he sees himself, because he's done bad things, there's no grey area for him. As far as he's concerned, he is a villain. And he's happy to be a villain because he thinks, if I'm a villain, then I can keep other people untainted. These people who I've put onto a pedestal. And because he has this really, really kind of black and white way of looking at things, he starts to sort of fray at the end because he realizes what he's doing is bad. But as far as he's concerned, the conclusion can only be good. So it's really messing with his mind. And he's very nervous and he's tense because a part of him is like, everything will resolve itself because this has got to be the right path. So it's got to resolve itself. There's no other way of doing it. There's no way things could just go bad because this is the right thing to do. But deep down he knows it's not the right thing to do, and he knows it's not as complex, it's more complicated than that, but he can't deal with it, and he can't, and obviously he can't vocalize it. So yeah, it's a very false victory for him because he gets Feren back, but he loses Rufus.
Yeah.
And he gets Feren back and sacrifices really a part of himself in the process, which he says that he's happy to sacrifice, but he doesn't actually realize the impact of it until Blood of the Delphi.
Zachary always strikes me as somebody who is so focused and single-minded on a goal that he never asks himself what it will actually cost and how he will live with it until after it's already happened.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. When he decides something's got to be done, then to hell with the consequences of it, really. Especially if those consequences have any bearing on him. If the consequences are with regard to someone else, then he might falter. But he is quite single-track minded.
Whereas obviously Rufus is all about consequences and overthinks everything right up until you piss him off enough for him to stop.
Yeah, and then he just explodes.
Which I suppose leads us to our other main character, which is Faye. And Faye sort of holds you at arm's length throughout the Sons of Thestion
She does.
and then
And
disappears quite mysteriously.
yeah, and we get a lot more of an insight into her in Blood of the Delphi,
Yeah.
because she doesn't have a choice in the matter. And the way I always saw it is the Sons of Thestion was very much a story about running away, and Yonathan is running away from the future because he's afraid of it, and Rufus is running away from the past, and Faye is running away from her life. She's running away from the present.
Not that we ever realised that at the time.
No,
That's only in hindsight.
yeah, well, we don't realize that at the time, because both Yonathan and Rufus get over that running away instinct in some respects by the end of the book. Rufus has just got over his I've got to run away from the past. He's just accepted one tragedy of the past, and then another gets thrown at him, and he just spirals back to step one again. But yeah, both of them sort of get cured from that. And Faye, in some respects, does. She returns to the Neve, and she kind of returns with this new insight about her, which is that she's been living in kind of stagnation for a while, and something has changed and within her because she's developed these friendships and she has a new perspective. And there is still a little bit of stagnation, but she starts to heal. And you learn about that. In Blood of the Delphi, which was it was fascinating because I loved writing her interactions with Rufus. Her interactions with Rufus were always fantastic because they're born enemies, really.
Yeah.
Yet somehow they manage to be friends, but they constantly argue, almost constantly.
Always seems to me to be the way that they communicate. It's
Yeah.
just the way they communicate best is by constantly trying to score points off each other.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily malicious, and as they start to understand each other a little bit more, they do get better of it. But the thing I like about Faye and Rufus's relationship is that Faye does not take any crap from Rufus. And when Rufus is at his worst, Faye is there for him, but she calls him out when he does shitty things.
Yeah.
At one point in Blood of the Delphi, he almost he unintentionally guilt trips her, tries to guilt trip her. And she turns around and she says, "Don't do that." And at another point, he says, "I know you don't trust me." And she turns around and says, "Well, thank God that you're here to tell me what I'm thinking. That's great. I was very confused otherwise." And she calls him out instantly, which is what he needs because Rufus becomes very self-absorbed when he's in pain. It's a defense mechanism, and he can't see beyond it. And so he needs people to turn around and say, "Actually, we're here for you. We're here to help you, but we're not gonna take this rubbish from you. Yeah. And we're not going to let you give this rubbish to yourself either.
Which Rufus does need, in fairness.
Yeah, he needs some cuddling, to be honest. But yeah, the reason Rufus does hit rock bottom in Blood of the Delphi. He hits real rock bottom. And it's actually because he has more to lose now than he did before.
I think a lot of it is... this won't be a spoiler, but we start off Blood of the Delphi. Is it 13 years later?
12, 13 years later.
And basically Rufus has been on the run the entire time and he's been hunted all the time. And you'll know this from the from literally the prologue. So I'm really not giving it away. I'm not giving anything away. But I think Rufus's sense of identity, certainly at the beginning as we get it, is very much tied up with Joshua and with protecting him. And his sense of worth is also tied up with those things as well. So if it looks at any point as if he is, say, failing, then he's not just failing Joshua or himself, he's failing his entire concept of himself.
Yeah, and it's because, as you said at the end of book one, the only thing that stopped him hitting rock bottom was Joshua. And he's put everything onto that. He's obsessed. He has obsessed over it. He's put everything onto Joshua. And if that slips up in any way, he's gone, because he hasn't actually dealt with the issue. He's just postponed it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a fair way of putting it. And there's a slightly different way. Zachary becomes a slightly different character again. He's still quite mercurial. He's still, and yet, you know, very black and white in his worldview. But you can tell almost from his viewpoint segments that he's hiding the truth from himself a lot of the time. He's well aware of what it is. He's just not looking at it straight on. He's kind of got it in the corner of his eye.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. And there is actually a line in it where he's basically told, you know, he's good at disguising his heart, but he should try less hard to disguise it from himself, because he's going to make himself sick. And he goes, shut up, I'm not disguising anything. This is how I feel. Beatrice is there like, sure, right.
Yeah, Zachary, we believe you.
No one believes you, but all right, whatever you want to say. And going back to, you know, saying how when you put them on the edge of the volcano, you're going to see who they really are. That's exactly what's happening. And that's why Rufus hits rock bottom in Blood of the Delphi, is because he's terrified of actually who he is he's constantly in threat, and he feels like he has actually met who he really is, and he's running away from that.
I think that's the thing though, isn't it? Because quite often a character's greatest strength is also their greatest weakness. Rufus's greatest strength is that he will accept everyone except himself, which is his greatest weakness.
Yeah.
And Zachary's is, you know, he's single-minded, he'll get things done, but once he's committed to a path, even if he knows it's the wrong path, he will still slavishly follow that path, because admitting he would be wrong would be, I don't know, it would somehow shatter that black and white worldview, and it would be too hard for him in some ways to incorporate more the shades of grey.
Yeah. And you pretty much, you got it in one. And yeah, Rufus has met that. He doesn't want to accept the darker part of him, because he sees it as dark and he can't really consider it as anything else. And Zachary doesn't want to meet that, his true self, because he's lying. He's lying to himself and pretending that he's happy with the way things are. He's lying to himself and pretending that he is loyal and has made the right decision, and that he doesn't regret the decision he made. Because if he admits that he does, and if he admits that they made a mistake, there's no coming back from it, and he's terrified of that.
Yeah, he'll have to act. It's really interesting actually watching, I mean, we're talking very obliquely here to not give anything away, but it's interesting watching the characters around him and how they interact, and you can almost feel them sort of exchanging looks behind his back, as if to say, okay, should we push him a little bit on this?
Yeah, he really worries a lot of the characters throughout. He very much worries his friends. And the thing about Zachary is that I think there was a line and it was actually removed, so I don't mind talking about it. Zachary has a moment of kind of fear when he realizes that he knows that all of his friends are also suffering from the decision that they've made, but all of his friends have got someone who are just for them. And Zachary knows that if it came down to him or Emmerich, Marcel would choose Emmerich. This is not something he resents, it's just something he knows. That those two are in love with each other. And to be honest, he completely understands that decision. But at the same time, there was a moment in one of the earlier drafts where he suddenly went, but I don't have anyone. I don't have anyone. And that kind of means that he's even more disguised around other people because he thinks, but they don't actually really care about me.
Yeah.
When most of them do. The most of them are just there like, oh God, please, someone help this person. Because he's busy trying to take care of everyone else, whilst blatantly denying the fact that he's hurting himself.
Okay, well, moving on slightly, let's look at Blood of the Delphi is a much darker book, I think, in tone.
Yeah.
I'm glad we agree on that.
Yep. Well, it's not fluffy, that's for sure.
It's not a fluffy read. Bad things happen. Bad things happen to people you care about. It's fine, I'll be over it. Just give me 10, 20 years.
You won't be over it.
I won't be over it, no. I'll be talking about it on my death. But would you say that... Okay, there's a common saying, adversity builds character. Would you say that that was something that was sort of in the back of your mind when you were making it a much darker book?
I don't know. I think what was running in the back of my mind was that my two main characters, Rufus and Zachary, are both stubborn idiots, and only utterly destroying them would make them see sense.
Yeah.
Specifically with Zachary, you had to bring him down to rock bottom to make him go, oh, now I see where I went wrong here.
Unfortunately, I can't say that because that might spoilify people, but yes, I can see how you might need to get Zachary down to that level, and then he might see that if certain things arrange themselves in the right way.
Yeah.
Is all I will say.
It was also... again, without wanting to spoil too much, I also try to be a little bit original in the way that I made them face adversity. And I don't know whether I succeeded. Do you feel I succeeded, Jules?
I would have said so, yeah. Because it would be a lot easier if you were starting, you're pitching off a new novel, and okay, admittedly it's the second one in the series, but you know, you could read it as a standalone if you absolutely had to, I think. I don't know why you'd want to, but you could do. And it would be a lot easier to have a sense of normalcy at the beginning, you know, to start off not with Rufus completely hunted, or if he's hunted, then for him to be sort of laughing them off, almost in a sort of Disney-esque Robin Hood way, as in sort of like, well, yeah, they're after me, but I've been at this game a long time and they haven't got close yet.
Yeah.
And it's not. What we come in on is a wretched man who is very, very close to the end of his tether and is really only hanging on to his sanity by his fingertips, and we don't know why.
Yeah, and we don't know why for a long time.
And you could say the same of Zachary. I think Zachary's pretty close to being nuts at that point when we come in on him. It's only his sort of wry, dark humour in the situation. And he's not laughing at anyone else. He's laughing at himself. The whole time he's lying to himself, he's laughing at himself.
I've said it before, but one of the things I really liked about writing Zachary is making him... is the contrast between the things he says and the things he does. Because obviously the things he says, he's saying them as much to himself as he is to anybody else.
Yeah.
And there's just this one bit where he's in a chapel and he's doing nothing wrong, right? He's just in a chapel and it's perfectly loud and there's no problem at all. And he hears someone coming and his automatic instinct is to hide. He just goes, and he hides. And he doesn't just do it once, he does it twice.
Yeah, there's something very self-destructive about Zachary as well. Because there are points where he almost embraces the lie, but he is too intelligent not to see when he's being played as well.
He wants to. He wants to embrace the lie because he wants it to be true, and it's not. And rock bottom for him is actually him coming to terms with the fact that it's not true, and him facing his absolute worst nightmare, his fears. But, you know, you'd have thought, you don't, if you, that isn't actually his rock bottom. What happens to him? You know, something rather unpleasant happens to him. And the whole way through, it's been kind of written out that this is, that will be his rock bottom. If he hits that, that'll be his rock bottom. But I don't think it is. His rock bottom really is that there's a moment where he is genuinely wishing for death. And he almost gets it. But yeah, something unpleasant happens.
I'm still not convinced that's his rock bottom. I'm convinced that his rock bottom will come if and when he emerges on the other side and has to confront himself. That's my theory. Fan theory.
Well, I can't say anything about that.
No, damn you. Okay, looking at sort of the more, I suppose, esoteric elements, the portrayals of darkness actually personified, we've got, of the Tuatha De Danann, we've got Morrigan, or yep. Morrigan, as she's in this, and we've also got Nick Niven. Nick Niven is super creepy, by the way.
Yes!
Talk about your fairies.
Oh, you said it before I did.
I did. I've put the F jar away for today.
Should we start with Nick Niven or should we start with Morrigan?
Start with Morrigan.
Start with Morrigan.
Because she's, I don't, is she bad? Is she following her own agenda? Is she bad from our perspective?
Well, she has a reason. So I think the whole kind of bad, I mean, you have Nick Niven and she also has a reason for doing what she does, but her reason is really, you know, shitty. So she's bad. She has a purpose, but, you know, she's definitely evil. She's not someone, you know, she's doing it for herself. And Morrigan is actually quite reminiscent of Ren from the first book.
Yeah.
Morrigan absolutely has a reason for why she's doing what she's doing. And she's willing to destroy anything in her path to get what she wants. And, you know, Morrigan is, there was hints at it in the first book. She's the one responsible for the spell that killed Yonatan. So there's immediately a complicated relationship between her and Rufus. But I think actually one of the reasons Rufus really struggles with himself is because a part of him is very, very drawn to her. And it's not a part of him that's drawn to her because of his darker nature. A part of him is drawn to her because of actually his emotional nature.
Yeah, I can see that.
So I don't know whether I'm answering your question here or if I'm just rambling.
She is, obviously the Morrigan in myth and legend is slightly different, but there's elements of that. And she is effectively a force of nature. She is a personification of perhaps the baser desires for sex and violence and dominion, I suppose. And she is a great deceiver.
But she never lies.
No, she never lies. But I think sometimes people who deceive best are those who are best at bending the truth. And so there's something a bit more diabolical about them. And I can see Rufus being attracted to that because he has a naturally chaotic nature.
Yeah, he's definitely chaotic in his form. He's chaotic good, whereas Zachary is sort of more along the lines of lawful neutral. I don't know, actually. I don't know where they stand in that.
It'd be worth doing the test and finding that out, really.
I might do the test, because that would actually be quite interesting.
this is the test on what sort of morality you've got.
and Rufus is very much chaotic good, because he believes in doing the right thing, but he doesn't actually really mind what... He will gladly break the law if he thinks that it's the right thing to do. And he has done it. I mean, the whole reason he became a Magi was because he broke into the royal archives. The thing is that he's so tame, people kind of forget that this is a guy who has and will continue to break the law if that's what he wants to do, because he will just go, nope, that's actually the thing that's best for us, so this is a stupid law, we're gonna break it. So definitely chaotic good. And Morrigan has that chaotic aspect to her as well. And I think she doesn't think that she's doing good, but she thinks she's getting justice.
Yeah, okay. Obviously, we don't fully know her motivations, so.
No, not yet.
Yeah.
I know her motivation.
Whereas, I mean, but I would still say she was a personification of the dark note in the book, because
Yeah.
she's definitely a, shall we say, a path to temptation for Rufus.
Yeah, and but she's not just a path for temptation for Rufus, she's a very viable path.
Yeah.
She's a genuine possibility, and not in a, oh gosh, what if he goes down the dark road. She is a genuine possibility of the person he could become if he needed, if it came down to it.
Yeah. Whereas Nick Niven appears to be entirely self-involved.
She is.
She's not interested in how her story or her she would fit into the greater story as a whole, or how she would affect things. She is entirely motivated by her own self-interest. Not that we see a lot of her, and she is super creepy, just in case that didn't come across before.
Nick Niven is an interesting one because she is very much a background character. And it's kind of good if she's a background character because I think if she wasn't, she would dominate the story in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And she's not actually about dominating. No, that's a lie. You know, she will gladly dominate everything. But it's as you say, she's very self-involved. She has her own thing going, and she doesn't care about the consequences because she always knows she's going to come out on top. This is a person who understands their own power.
Yeah.
This is a person who understands where they lie in the hierarchy of things. So everything that's happening around her is fairly inconsequential because she's at the top of the food chain and she knows she's at the top of the food chain. And if she sees things happening and goes, oh, wait, well, if I just sort of prod my finger in there, I can get something that I want, she'll do it. But she's not that concerned. She's quite laid back in that
Yeah,
respect.
no, I can see that.
She's very chill.
As long as you're not in her way.
Yeah, as long as you're not in her way. She's one of these characters who is very much totally detached from what's happening. She might gain pleasure from tearing someone to pieces, but it wouldn't be a vindictive kind of pleasure. She'd probably just enjoy it in the same way you might enjoy, I don't know, a bag of Skittles. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And it would be a bad idea for me to try and enjoy a bag of Skittles. Massively allergic to the food colouring.
Okay, oh, that's good to know.
Although, if you ever want to see something very, very funny, you can give me Skittles.
No, Jules.
I
Don't encourage that kind of behavior.
am reliably informed it's hilarious. I don't know because I can never remember.
I am concerned about your friendship group. Anyway, I think, to be honest, the whole second book is about the destruction of all of the characters.
Yeah, it's very much like, okay, weirdly, a sonata, whereby the first book you establish the theme, and the second book you then deconstruct the theme and really examine it. And then hopefully in the third book you'll re-establish the theme as something better and
Yeah.
happier.
Well, the way I see it, the end of the first book, everyone split off and went down their different paths.
Yeah.
And for the third book, they're all going to need to come back together again, whether they're colliding, whether they're joining each other, it doesn't really matter. The point is that they all split off and they need to come back together again. And so to come back together again, they need to get onto, some of them need to get onto different paths.
Yeah.
And the only way a lot of them were going to get onto different paths were if they were totally destroyed. And it's not just, and it happens to all of them on some level or another. They are brought to the brink where they have to re-examine who they are. They have to re-examine what they really want and what they're willing to give to have it. And the way this is done is that they are put into situations which a lot of them are not prepared for. And what scares Rufus, as I said, what scares Rufus, brings him down to his ultimate low, is that he does something which he never thought himself capable of. And Zachary, what scares Zachary is that he is reintroduced to something, a phobia he has. He has this phobia which has sort of been sort of hinted at in the first book again, and he suddenly realizes he has to face it, and that is what destroys him. The fear of having to face it, actually, rather than having to face it himself, itself rather, because we never actually get to see that. But in other respects, Faye too is kind of made to face, is kind of destroyed in another way, which is that Faye left the first book with her ideas of humanity kind of crumbled a little bit because she, you know, she didn't think that much of what was happening. She didn't think badly, but she, you know, she was quite detached from that, and suddenly she had a new perspective, which changed everything for her. And then she kind of reapproaches it with slightly rose-tinted glasses, and it's destroyed again because she sort of she finds Rufus. She's there like, way, you know, I'm back with my friend, and oh God, oh he's a mess. Oh God, what, what? What have you been doing the last 12 years? Lord almighty, man.
Yes. Well, I'm glad that you're torturing them all for a reason.
Oh, I am torturing them all
That's
for a
a great
reason.
source of comfort.
But it's, you know, it's also the side characters. You meet a character named Beatrice Hathley, who's Marcel's sister, who for those who are who know my shorter works, she's appeared briefly before. And you meet her and you meet Varen, and Embar Reagan comes back. And again, they all face it to a certain degree. The second book is very much about destroying them.
Yeah, which is interesting actually. If talking about, we've got time just to talk about Varen a little bit, who is a side character but one of my favourites. And I would say he, you know, he's pretty much been tortured for quite a long time, really.
He's
Of it, yeah, a lot happens off screen.
He's been very unfortunate in a lot of his life, very much a survivor.
But you know, going back to our original Firefly quote, I do feel that we've sort of. He's already been up on the volcano for a little bit now, and I feel that we sort of really meet him as we come in, you know, because he's already had pretty much everything taken away from him
Well,
or withheld.
yeah. I mean, at this point, actually, the thing that will make Varen is for him to gain something. So things kind of go uphill for Varen, actually. In the That's a lie. That's a blatant lie. They do not go uphill for him. They go uphill, but they go uphill for him more than some of the other characters who I destroy. Varen has kind of already been destroyed, has more an opportunity to sort of make things better. He will return, and he'll probably be stronger than everyone else because they're all still getting over their stuff, and he's all there like, oh no, kind of way ahead of you guys. I'm just gonna save the day now because you're all useless. Will be a little bit of what's happening with Varen in the next book.
And obviously, none of us actually really believe you when you say things will get better, so.
No, that's I am lying. Things are
No,
gonna
you are.
get so significantly worse. It's gonna be hilarious. People are gonna die. Next book. People are gonna die. There will be death.
Okay, slightly away from our main topic today. What bit of Blood of the Delphi would you say you enjoyed writing most?
Oh gosh. I mean, I loved destroying Zachary. That was hilarious. No, sorry, that's the wrong word. It was great to write his internal sort of no, I'm fine, no, I'm fine, no, I'm fine, you're bleeding, no, I'm fine.
Tis a flesh wound.
Just nothing but a flesh wound. Your arm's off. Which is very much what was going on throughout his entire thing. His entire story is just blatant denial to the point where everyone knows it's blatant denial, but he's holding out. Until the very end, where he goes, yeah, it was denial. What I really enjoyed, I loved introducing some of the new characters, and I loved getting to know some of them, because as you said, you find out who a person really is when you put them into those situations. I've heard another version, which is that you don't know how strong a woman is until she gets into hot water, which I always quite liked. You know, I saw it on one of those fridge magnets. But I always thought that was quite a nice thing. And yeah, you don't actually know the true flavor, the true strength, or the true weakness of a character until they are in trouble. And book two is definitely everyone is in trouble.
And it is obviously pressure that creates diamonds.
Yeah, exactly. Or you know, just crumbles people to dust. So I actually really got to know some of the characters in a way that I didn't know them before in the second book, which was fascinating for me. It was very exciting, and yeah, I like that I got to introduce some characters. Because I've been sitting on them for a while, you know, sitting on them in book one, going, now I get to finally introduce them. So I get to, you know, I got to introduce Erin and Varen, and Beatrice, and Daniel. Daniel Zachary is another side character who appears in the second book, who I just loved introducing him. I thought he was great.
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying not to say anything that will give the game away.
Yeah. No spoilers for book two. But yeah, wasn't it very intense book to write, because so many horrible things did happen. And I think it's fair to say that there is a quite a prominent theme of abuse in the second book.
Yeah. Various different types, yeah.
Various different types of abuse, child abuse, sexual abuse, mental abuse, and abusive relationships, also in friendships as well as in you know, relationships, and the relationship between Zachary and Sverin, I think, could only probably be described as an abusive relationship.
Yeah, definitely.
So there were a lot of undercurrents. It was just a pleasure to write. It was fantastic. And it was non-stop from start to finish. And I was really worried that actually people wouldn't like it. I was really worried people would find it boring, because there's a lot of political stuff that happens as well. But so far, everyone has said that they've enjoyed it.
Yeah,
So
definitely. Anyway, guys, we're gonna have to wrap it up there. As much as I'd like to keep you talking, but basically, if you haven't read Sons of Thestian, go and read it. What are you waiting for? I've already told you. And go and order Blood of the Delphi.
it's being released on the 28th of February. And for anyone in the Hampshire, Winchester area of the UK, if you want to get hold of Blood of the Delphi 3 whole days early, yeah. I'm doing a book launch in Winchester on the 25th, that's Saturday, starting at 6:30, and it's at Waterstones in the High Street. There's an events page that I will share to the Dissecting Dragons page, because why not? And everyone's welcome, it's free entry, and you can grab hold of Blood of the Delphi there and then and have it signed if you want. So, yeah, hopefully see you guys then, and yeah, I look forward to the general reactions
The cries of anguish.
the cries of anguish that every single person who has read it has come back to me in fury, and that sustains me. So thanks. And on that note, we'll catch you next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.